This podcast is brought to you by iGel. iGel offers the next generation edge operating system designed for simple, secure, and high performance access to virtual desktops and cloud workspaces. Easy to implement and straightforward to operate.
At the third stroke, it will be.
Hello and welcome to EUC Digest, your bi-weekly audio snack on everything EUC related. In today's show, we'll be talking about the holistic view of end-user computing, and of course with a very, very special guest. But before we dive into this holistic view on end-user computing and all its related details, please allow us to introduce ourselves. My name is Jitz Langedijk, and I'm your host for this episode. And of course, I'm not hosting this on my own. So my fellow host, my co-host is Kees Bacherman. So hi, Kees. How are you doing?
Hey, it's I'm doing good, thank you. Keeping warm in the Netherlands with the summer upcoming. So enjoying the weather. Not right now because we're sitting inside doing this podcast. So I'm good. How about yourself, man?
Yeah, exactly. I enjoyed the summer breeze today as well, right? So I took the dog for an extra walk today and enjoyed it. But as you said, it's warming up already. So let's get started. So what have you found out about our guest for today?
Well, obviously, I found some interesting facts. It's a very colorful person, our guest for today. He's a true EUC veteran and one of the founding members of the Citrix Technology Professional Program. I'm not sure if he does it today, but he drives pimped and tuned golf carts for fun. And he's not just a big supporter of the military. He's a veteran and even today part of the Federal Reserves. And last but certainly not least, he catches really big fish.
Oh, that's interesting. That's interesting. I hear already a little laughter. So if you still don't know who our guest of today is, please guest, introduce yourself.
This is Ron Oglesby with VMware.
Hi, Ron. Thank you for being on the show today. So, I think, you catched a really big fish. And as you said during, when you announced yourself, Ron Oglesby at VMware, but maybe that's a big fish, but also the big fishes that we've seen on Twitter or social media. So,
I don't know why I don't know why I feel the need to share. You know, pictures of my fish on social media. I just have this overwhelming need. It's kind of like there are people who take pictures of their plate of food at some restaurant or you know, they're on a walk and they take a picture of their dog. For me, it's, you know, it's fishing. It's something about, hey, everybody get up, get outside, get some of that vitamin D and do something. And in my world, it's fishing and hunting and stuff like that.
So that being said, I hardly ever see pictures of armadillos on Twitter. And I know there's a good story about that as well.
Yeah, we have an armadillo problem. Actually, it's about this time of year here in Texas that the armadillos start tearing up your yard. They'll dig up your mulch beds, dig up all your plants. They'll take your manicured, beautiful lawn and they'll dig trenches in it and tear up your sprinklers. And so I kill them, but you know, a lot of people love animals. And I mean, the armadillo is an ugly, stinky animal, but they still love them. And I don't want to offend anybody. For us, it's like pest control. It's like 5 and 6 pound rats and we're just trying to get rid of them. But, I try not to offend people on social media with my midnight armadillo hunting.
So you use a drone for the hunting exercise, or?
I wish. I haven't figured that out yet. You know, I'd have to have an armed drone, with remote control. It's technology. We could figure it out. But no, I wind up going outside in the middle of the night. I set up a passive infrared sensor to alert me when they cross it.
Booby traps.
And it goes, it sets off an alarm in my bedroom generally about 3 in the morning, and I have to go outside and chase this armadillo down and get rid of it.
So I happen to know, and I work at NVIDIA, so I know quite a few people that have been training neural networks that at least they can do some object detection and classification. So it would be easy to have just a Jetson Nano with a 4K camera attached to it, and you can train a network to recognize the armadillos, and then take all the necessary actions once it's detected, right? So you could stay in your bed at 3 a.m. in the morning.
Yeah, it would. It would actually be a step one for that would just be to do recognition and then take an action on it. In my case, I'd like it to ignore raccoons, cats, ignore the deer that walks by. Only when you see the ugly armadillo should you ring the alarm in my bedroom.
So I'll get started on training a network. What's the percentage of accuracy that you're okay with?
Hey, yes, we can take that even further.
Yeah. At this point, pretty low.
Yeah.
Not long ago, during one of the so I work for Nutanix, and not long ago we showed a drone with an Intel NUC on top of it running Nutanix CE, our community edition. So we can have an autonomous data center flying or hovering over Ron's backyard, and together with combined technologies, I'm pretty sure we can make a very effective chasing mechanism.
Yeah, I'll make a note of that, and we'll follow up. Yeah, I see a business case here.
I actually see the federal government knocking on our door because we've got autonomous drones flying around a yard armed using. Using image detection and a flying data center, they're going to ask us what we're using it for, and we're going to try to tell them armadillos, and nobody's going to believe us.
Well, at least we have the podcast to prove it.
That's right.
Yeah, exactly. This is what. So if you go to Amazon in a couple of years, you heard it first here at the EUC Digest podcast. So, yeah. So great, but as we mentioned during the introduction, right? You are a true EUC veteran, and ever since I am in the EUC space, I know you. I know you by name and by face, and we've met a couple of times. But maybe can you guide us a little bit throughout your career?
No problem. I kind of got sucked into this space, what way back in the day was called the server-based computing space. Back in the WinFrame days, the early WinFrame, Citrix WinFrame days, I was essentially a support technician for a software company, picking up the phone, hello, this is Ron Oglesby, how can I help you today? And I got sucked into it because there were these printer calls that kept coming in where people couldn't get printers to work in WinFrame, and I just, being hard-headed, I wouldn't let it go. I just kept figuring out how to make the printers work for them. And that just led me down the path of eventually becoming Citrix certified back in the day. I was a Citrix instructor. I was one of the first CCEAs, if you remember those original certs.
Yeah. And
I did the Citrix thing and kind of the typical stuff you would see from end user computing consultants, right? Active Directory, Citrix. I did some Exchange stuff back in the day, migrations. And I followed the EUC path there until the early 2000s when VMware was really coming on the scene with their early versions of ESX. And I had a CEO that said, oh, we've got to look at this VMware stuff. And we looked at it and played with it and said, this is going to change the world, right? This server virtualization thing. And so I literally got out of EUC almost completely for about 4 or 5 years. I dove headfirst into ESX consulting and did that for 4 or 5 years for that consulting company. And then eventually Dell. And I was at Dell when I was recruited by the guys at Unidesk to come back into the EUC fold. And quite honestly, I was a little hesitant. I was working as part of their data center team. I was one of the principal kind of architects and practice execs at the data center team. I was, traveling to Japan and Australia and Europe. And I was like, man, do I really want to get back into EUC space? But once I saw the layering product, I was like, all right, yeah, I want to go do it. So I did layering with Unidesk for 7 years. We got acquired by Citrix. So I moved over to Citrix and spent about another year and a half, just doing transition work, right? Teaching people about layering and how to sell it and how to set it up. And then I ran communities at Citrix for about a year, the CTP program, the CUGC program, stuff like that. And then kind of wrapped up at the end doing just a little bit of PMM work right before I left.
That's an impressive resume you got there, Ron. A couple of bigger names in the industry in terms of vendors that you've worked for. Obviously, with all this kind of experience under your belt, could you mention a couple of personal highlights for us?
Personal highlights, things that were awesome in my career, or things that were just awesome in my personal life.
A bit of both.
Could be both. Yeah.
Well, being part of the Unidesk acquisition and being part of that leadership team there was, it was really amazing to me. And I got to work with some amazing people, people that in the EUC space that knew Unidesk, they knew Ron, right? Because I was in all the videos and all that. But like our CEO, Don Bulins, he was just an amazing, amazing man. Brilliant, right? He knew how to help people become better than they were. And he knew like what people's strengths and weaknesses were and always tried to play to their strengths. Chris Midgley, the guy who invented it, our CTO, we're still great friends today. He's just a genius, you know, and going through that with a bunch of people that you really like, you know, sometimes you hear these horror stories of startups where it's just struggle and churn and fire this VP and get rid of this person. And no, we're bringing in a new team and we're refunding. And for us, yeah, we had struggles, right? We were a startup, right? We always had struggles, whether it was, you know, you're trying to make enough sales to grow or to pay, you know, your employees, or whether it's code struggles, right? We've been doing this wrong for a year and a half. Let's change this code completely. But coming out on the other end with all the same people, without having fired people and restarted, you know, engineering or sales or whatever, it was probably one of the coolest experiences that I was part of in the technology world. Early in my career, I lucked out. I had another great CEO when I first started consulting. I had worked at a small consulting firm and then went out on my own for a while. And this CEO of a company called RapidApp in Chicago found out about me somehow through a customer, chased me, said, "You have to come work for us, right? We're you're peanut butter, we're chocolate, we're better together." And he really taught me about consulting. Him and a guy named Rob Zalowski really taught me about, you know, people who call themselves consultants are often generally just contractors, but they really taught me about consulting. And so if I look back on everything, kind of my intro into the real consulting world with RapidApp and guys like Rob Zalowski, and then my intro into real heavy startup software business with the people I had at RapidApp or the people I had at Unidesk, those were the highlights for me. They were just amazing, amazing people. And let's face it, right? People that work with you and can teach you things, they're worth their weight in gold.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Absolutely right. Yeah. And I can imagine, especially working at a startup when, everything just aligns, right? And there's this positive atmosphere. And then the outcome is, this acquisition as a team that, I completely understand that this is a highlight in your career. So The only thing is, you mentioned one of your earlier mentors or CEOs at a company that you worked for, and they said, "Well, this ESX thing, this virtualization tool that VMware has to offer, we should look at this." It took you quite some time before you joined VMware. So but you listened to him, right?
Yeah. Here's a funny story about that. And some of my friends know it. People that have known me for a long time know it. It was probably, 2005, 2006, somewhere in there. It was when VMware was first building their consulting organization, right? They had actually gained some commercial traction, and they were moving. And they had actually bought a number of my book, you know, several hundred or something of our ESX server book, mine and Scott Harrell's. And I got an interview to come and see if I wanted to like run teams or something at VMware on their consulting side. And I'd been doing it for 5 years and had wrote at the time the only book that was out there on ESX. And we had interviewed for about 30 minutes with my first interview. And at that point, he asked me, I don't see where you went to college, where you went to university. And I said, oh, I didn't. And his face went a little blank and said, I'm sorry, we can't hire you.
Oh, wow.
And at the time, they were only hiring university graduates. And they were in context, right? They're a company that was started with PhDs from Stanford and all that. And they were very academically focused in their recruitment early on. And I kind of get it. But yeah, it took me a long time to circle back and I guess eventually come back to VMware.
So yeah, there was one guy smart enough to actually hire you.
Yeah, Sean. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, that PhD. Well, yeah, it can be important. But then again, well, all the experience, as Case mentioned, all the experience that you have throughout your career, that's quite valuable to an organization, of course. So and you've proven yourself. So. But and you mentioned also your at Citrix, and I think most of the people already knew you from the community, but you also were from the other side actively engaged with community as well. But why is community and being a part of the community important to you as a person, but also why is it important for organizations? Or
is it important? Well, for me as a, you know, for me as a techie, I remember the days, you know, when there wasn't a lot of community out there, and especially in the EUC space, the early community was this thing called the thin.net group, and it was a mailing list, and it was just people who literally didn't know each other would randomly send emails out to this list and say, I'm having a problem with X. Has anyone ever seen this? And sometimes they'd get an immediate answer, kind of like in a forum somewhere. And sometimes they would get asked a bunch of questions and help to diagnose it. And I liked being on that because I had some folks on there that actually answered questions for me. And I kind of took to helping other people because why let people struggle, right? They're IT guys like us. I don't want to see them up at midnight tonight banging their head off the keyboard trying to figure out how to solve this if I know the solution. And what I found was when you get groups of people, and don't get me wrong, there's always outliers in any group that are antisocial or whatever. But when you get groups of people that generally are part of a community like that, they self-support. They might have different political views. They might have different views on religion. They might have different views on heck, how to fish, right? But when it comes to that one thing they share in common, that technology that they're all dealing with every day, it kind of brings them together. And what I saw was that, and I didn't really realize this until I went to Unidesk and we started to build a small community of people and built a forum for them to interact, was that not only was it good for them to know each other, but it was good as us for us as a company. We got so much value out of that. Them being honest with opinions and being able to tell us, here's what we want the product to do. You know, it was invaluable. It saved us so much time in development and prioritizing our backlog. And so when I went to Citrix, I wanted to say, look, grab all these CTPs and stick them in there with the PMs until they figure out what are the highest priority features. And because if a community is done right, those folks in the community, they gain access and insight to things they didn't know. They learn more. Their life gets better because they're learning more, whether it's they're not up at midnight troubleshooting something or they have new insight into how to use a product, they become your biggest advocates. And on the flip side, as a company, if you leverage them right, you can cut down your development time. You can stop, you know, we've all seen it. You develop a feature for a product and you develop it in this black hole of PMs and engineers, and then you roll it out, right? And you give it to the PMMs and they make some slides for it, and you roll it out and you showed it on the screen the first time, and everybody in the audience just stared at it and had, they're like, yeah, okay, not very exciting.
Well, what's the problem you're solving with this feature?
Yeah, they're like, oh, well, yeah, I think I heard one customer talk about that, but not my other 88, you know? And think about all the wasted man hours that went into that feature, and then flip it on its head. Think about how an engineer and a PM who have spent their time and their energy, and the QA folks who have made sure it all works, and they've spent 8 months building this thing and ignoring revenue and expense. Imagine the personal feeling that they have when it falls flat in front of an audience. So you can get a real human human emotion and a level of satisfaction if your product hits correctly. And I think that getting that feedback from the community really helps. Now, is that to say that the community is right in every instance of everything? No, because they're human too. And a lot of folks that we think of as grand innovators, just these people who see a need for something, and the community and the general purchasers don't even see the need yet. Sometimes there are innovators that are just way ahead of their time, you know, and back before iPhones, if anyone would have said, you know what you need is a phone that'll have your music on it, and you can put it in your pocket and you can listen to music on it, and eventually we're going to have apps. And people are like, well, what are the apps going to do? It'll do anything. It'll tell you what the barometric pressure is currently outdoors. And you're like, well, I can look on the TV. I don't need that. It'll tell you the weather. Well, I don't really need that. Well, we didn't need it until someone actually made it and we realized their vision, you know? So it's a balancing act, really.
Yeah, it's like Henry Ford, right? If he would ask to his customers, what do you need? Just a faster horse or new, something different. Yeah.
I need a horse that eats less hay. You know, they'd say something like that.
Yeah. And works twice as hard.
Yeah, you bet.
I think that's a great segue to our next question as well. And it's something that that Jitz and I have been kind of dabbling about just together. How are you seeing the overall usage of end user computing solutions being changing over the years? Like, given the history that you have, are you seeing a lot of shifts within the end user computing kind of space?
Yeah, it's almost looked like a radio wave or a frequency wave, you know. And initially, of course, in the early days, it was almost completely about remote access, whether it was people dialing in via 14.4 or 28.8 modems, or whether they were on some type of fractional T1 line at a remote office and they were running these applications that required file servers. You know, back then it would have been NetWare file servers. And it was just the apps were so slow over this fractional T1 that, you know, centralized computing or server-based computing, moving the processing closer to the data made sense. Eventually, you started seeing bigger organizations. A lot of them early in the game were financial businesses and hospitals started saying, our apps, not just the data, but our apps are really big. You know, we're installing a lot bits and bytes wise on that local C drive. And our updates take a long time and we only have really tiny maintenance windows. And so a lot of companies started moving to things like Citrix Metaframe and whatnot and trying to deploy apps just to desktops, right? And that was kind of a big peak back in the late 90s, early 2000s, where you saw organizations attempting to use everything from straight, you know, Metaframe using published apps to eventually things like Softricity and SoftGrid, which eventually became AppV when they were acquired by Microsoft, trying to stream the apps. They were really trying to solve a desktop management problem, right? They were tired of the packaging headaches, and then once the app is packaged and right, the distribution of that package, you know, not just within some little local LAN, but sometimes in gigantic LANs, you know, 10,000 users in a certain location, and then of course all their distributed and remote workers. And the interesting thing is, people have and companies have bounced back and forth on that. They've, you know, okay, we're going to try it this way. We've ran that way for 3 or 4 years. It's pretty good for these, but we're going to try another way, right? We're going to try AppV. We're going to try to convert some of our apps to web apps. We're going to, you know, move to layering after AppV because we struggled with AppV maybe, or it worked for these apps, but not these. And now the really interesting thing is, I think in the early EUC days and even through the 2000s, the technology was looked at as a very bits and bytes technology. And the practitioners of it, you know, I always think about Steve Greenberg out in Arizona, you know, an early EUC consultant, and ran a whole business around having really smart people deploying Citrix and PVS and doing all that. It was very bits and bytes, and it didn't look at the picture holistically. But what you've seen in the last few years, and now you're going to see accelerate because of this whole COVID-19 thing, is people have realized that end user computing isn't one problem or a couple of problems. It's a whole series of problems and a whole series of expectations. And, you know, we've almost solved, the bandwidth problem is kind of solved, right? It depends on who you are and where you are, of course. But, you know, compared to 14.4 modems, we have unbelievable bandwidth to people's phones and in Starbucks and, you know, all these on planes now. And that experience and the devices people use and how they interact and how these apps interact it's a much bigger picture than just the bits and bytes technology of, I'm going to stream this one app because I have a Novell file server here. We have now a much bigger problem that encompasses everything from security to variations in mobile devices, all that. And it's actually kind of nice to see EUC is no longer this thing on the shelf that is a problem and we throw some budget at it and we just, okay, you guys just do that wizard voodoo weird stuff you do over there to keep these apps running. Now it's actually at the forefront where, you know, the world has changed. We kind of thought we knew how everything was going to go, and then this got thrown at us, and it's even more important now to look at the whole workspace and understand everything from how people get signed into various apps, what type of security is wrapped around that, what type of machine learning on the back end is watching logins and access. And now I'll get you to your app, regardless of where your app is or what type of app it is, et cetera. It's at the forefront of everybody's mind now.
Would you say that we're transforming from tactical to strategical, something that most of us have been kind of looking at for or eyeballing for years? But I think that the whole situation that the world is in is kind of rapidly accelerating that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think it's going to be strategic now because, you know, I read an article just a couple of days ago, and this is going to sound way out in left field, but it was an article about these real estate agents in Tahoe and how they said in the last, you know, 6 weeks, they've taken more requests and more requests to view properties or talk about property details in 6 weeks than they had in like the previous 2 or 3 years. And the reason that's important is because people are now realizing whether it's, you know, and I hate to use the word fear, but whether it's fear of being in a city or whether they're just realizing that, hey, I've lived in this city for 10 years. I've paid, you know, an exorbitant amount for my apartment that I live in. But now I've done my job at home for 2 or 3 months. Well, if I could do my job at home for 2 or 3 months, why couldn't I do my job from home all the time? And why shouldn't I live someplace else? I think it's going to change real estate values. I think it's going to change the way people look at work. And I think that these bigger organizations are going to start to look at remote work. We're not even going to call it remote work, but that's what it is still today in our lexicon. They're going to start looking at where people want to work from as a way to retain employees, as a way to gain new employees. And they're starting to realize that human nature is going to move how users access their apps and get into the network and all that and work and be efficient is not just good for employee retention, but is also eventually going to be great for the actual efficiency. You know, if I'm paying someone in the Bay Area versus paying someone in North Dakota, you know, in the United States, those pay scales are very different. And I think that that's going to be a strategic thing for companies too. And how they deal with their end user computing needs is going to be a central pillar of whatever they do in the future.
Yeah, it's definitely. It's an interesting point. I'm not sure if you caught that just recently, Jitz, but I think Facebook is kind of deploying a strategy of work from home for permanent. But I also read that Zuckerberg is thinking about reducing pay if you move out of the Bay Area. Mm-hmm. So his kind of thought process there is it's great that you can work from home, but if you move to a cheaper area, why should I pay you a salary that fits the Bay Area kind of profile of cost mm-hmm. and living?
Yeah, there's going to be some of that. Yeah, there's going to be some of that correction. There's no doubt about that. And don't get me wrong. Everybody would love to have a Bay Area salary and live in Fargo, North Dakota, you know, and well, maybe they don't want to live in Fargo, North Dakota. I don't know, but you're exactly right on that point. But the thing about it is how does that correction work out? Well, maybe if he says we'll reduce your pay, his existing employees go, yeah, no, I don't want my pay reduced. I'll just stay here. Right. You know, maybe they do. Maybe some do say, well, how much is the reduction? And they do a cost of, you know, they go online, they do a cost of living calculator and they go, well, even though my pay is going down, I can buy a larger house or I can have a different quality of life here. And that's what I want to do. And even if none of them took him up on the offer and said, nope, we're all just going to stay here and maintain our salaries. The ability to allow them to work from anywhere with teams and products that they're developing and working on. Guess what? Tomorrow, when they have to run an ad for three new engineers on whatever team, it's no longer going to say, you know, the Bay Area or Palo Alto or the Valley. It's going to say, we don't care where you work from. And what'll happen naturally over time is maybe that 23-year-old that just graduated from university and has a computer science degree and is looking for a gig, and he had, you know, his typical path 5 years ago would have been, I'm going to move to the Valley or move to Austin, Texas, or move to, you know, Boston or wherever they're doing more app development. He's going to go, I'm going to go online and look for these jobs. And maybe he gets what he considers a nice, good paying job, but he stays right where he is or within, you know, a small geographical movement. And then it just becomes natural attrition at that point. So there's some interesting stuff there. You know, there's stuff that I don't think we even all understand yet, but that human nature is going to dictate kind of how these things change. And from now on, or at least for the near term foreseeable future, for the next 3 years, every organization in the world has been impacted by this, and they're going to have to look at EUC and how people access data and how they access apps and how they communicate. It's strategic now.
Yeah, absolutely. But as you said, well, today, and you probably can relate to this as a former Citrix employee, but work, after all, is something that we do, right? Not a place that we go to.
Yeah.
So, yeah. But the article with the real estate agencies, did it also mention something about virtual reality? Because I can imagine, and in these days, when people want to see a house, at least they can also use new technology to allow mm-hmm. people to take a look around, right? Or
yeah, well, with real estate agencies, especially here in the U.S., I'm not sure how it is everywhere else, but typically there's not just photos anymore. There's 3D virtual tours and the ability to look up everything from petty crime statistics to school ratings, you know, how good are the schools and stuff. And yeah, they can get a pretty good look at where they want to go before they actually even spend a dime to go out and actually see it in person.
See how the lawn is doing and how much is it affected by some sort of animals.
Did they Photoshop that lawn? I want to know.
Yeah. Yeah. So you want a 24/7 webcam just to make sure. So, but you mentioned, and it's the second time I come back to this, right? But you mentioned the virtualization technology with ESX that was coming to play, right? But this was a big game changer from a technical point of view in the EUC space. Could you pinpoint one specific game changer in this whole evolution of the EUC world?
Well, yeah, I mean, obviously the original stuff was all back in the 90s with Windows being partitioned up into today what we would consider virtual workspaces, right? Sessions, individual sessions. You know, I think the biggest thing that's changed EUC or impacted EUC, at least from my perspective, has been the bandwidth. I just can't get over the bandwidth changes. You know, you can actually watch the increase in bandwidth at both a personal level on devices and at home, and at a corporate level. I mean, you know, there were days when people for a T1 to a remote office, someone was paying, you know, $10,000 or $12,000 a month for a T1, you know, a meg and a half pipe. I mean, that's, if I was to tell my daughter that, who's a computer science major down at university, she would lose her mind if I told her it was 10 grand for a meg and a half pipe. But I think that bandwidth did it, which isn't a single point of anything. It's just this continual growth, just like processor speeds or anything else. And it just changed the way we use devices. It changed everything, and that's what seriously has impacted EUC the most over the years.
So I've got another angle there because I've been thinking about that question as well. What about end users? Because, you know, the technology is great. It's great that we're kind of evolving the technology, but I don't have the experience that you have, Ron. I'm not that old. But end users have been kind of morphing and changing in terms of what they demand, what they expect, how they kind of interact with devices, with apps, with data. I think it's kind of a shift from that perspective as well.
Yeah, no doubt. I don't have to bring it up anymore because now it's kind of common knowledge in the business world and all that, but I remember 5, 7, 10 years ago trying to explain to people that the quote unquote kids they were bringing into their company that were 23, 24, 10 years ago, I said they grew up knowing technology. They weren't my mother. They weren't me. Someone didn't have to sit them down in front of a keyboard and a desktop PC and go, "This is where you put your floppy disk in." When the sign-in screen comes up, you have to type in your password, right? No one had to do that for these kids. They grew up to it. They grew up with it, and it became intuitive. And, like, my daughter's never put a DVD into a DVD player. She's just never done it. And that means that when that kind of group of kids that always grew up with technology, that had a phone since they were 10 years old, all of a sudden are no longer the quote unquote kid and the lowest man on the totem pole in a team at some company. And now they're a senior team member, or they're now managing a team because they've been there 6 years at this company or whatever. Guess what they're going to want? They're going to want all of that work stuff to flow like it does in their personal devices that they've always used. And you're exactly right. That's just human nature, I think. And it's kind of like we go back to, you brought up Ford and the Model T. You know, I'm sure the Model T had been out, right? Cars had been around for 20 years. And I'm pretty sure there was still some guy who grew up on a horse and said, ah, those car things are a fad, right? They're going to go away eventually. They're too noisy. People keep getting in accidents. And that's kind of what they're going to look at the early days of EUC is. And yeah, it's changed to what people demand, right? I mean, and Kays, you'll know this, is that as that demand popped up, right, people's behavior changed. Younger folks grew into business positions and they're using technology different. The flip side of that is there was a big drive years ago that, hey, every app's got to be mobile. Hey, make everything a web app. Nope, stop with the web stuff. Make an actual mobile app. Well, for which one? I don't know. Make it for iPhone, iTablet. No, Android. What's Android? Do we have to make it for that? And one of the things that I've seen is that until we get like some Elon Musk Neuralink going on, Neuronet, Neuralink, where I can think and my computer can just put all the data in, we are actually limited by our fingers and our input abilities to input data. I've never seen anyone write a white paper on an iPhone, right? Just as an example. Just like big data entry apps, you know, if you're a caseworker for a state agency that goes and checks on children, you might be able to go on an iPhone and have a mobile version of your app that allows you to say, yes, there were four kids. Yes, they were okay. Yes, I checked in on this date. But if you were actually going to input any type of substantial data, you know, we're almost slaves to our keyboard in so many cases, unless it's simple data entry. And that's a big limiting factor today. People until I get my Neuralink from Elon Musk, people are going to sit there and at some point they're going to have to get in front of a keyboard and write algorithms, write code, do big data entry, edit spreadsheets. You know, all that stuff's still going to happen because it's not so much the app is bad. It's we have to have a way to take this high bandwidth network in our head and via some low bandwidth method of typing, get that thoughts and data into the system.
Yeah, that almost answers our next questions, to be honest, because the question is, what's missing in today's world? But in today's world of EUC, to be more specific, but maybe Neuralink is already the answer, right? But I'm not sure whether I would sign up for the beta program. But
yeah, I don't know. I saw a piece of an interview with Elon Musk where he was talking about, you know, they're going to have to cut a small hole in your skull and insert these things. And, you know, obviously version one will be, you know, hey, we're going to fix some physical ailment or some brain condition. But if you think about it, eventually we have to find a better or faster way to input data than our keyboards. I don't know if it's, you know, voice to text and things like that that people have tried for years and years, but it's something we have to think about. As far as what's really missing in EUC today, I don't know that anything's missing. There's so many, you know, besides us at VMware and Citrix and all the partners that are out there, you know, there's not this gigantic hole. There's a bringing together of all these various and disparate technologies that form that workspace. And right now they're just that. And sometimes we have a technological difficulty where this tech does it this way and this tech does it this way. And those two can't do anything without some clunky type of translation mechanism in between them. But it's really integration, you know, it's integration between all these products to make them, if not be a holistic solution, actually feel like a holistic solution to the end user.
I think that's spot on. The word that came up to my mind was simplicity. Like what's mm-hmm. missing in today's world, it's simplicity because of the technology stack being so complex. So with that, you're now part of the Office of the CTO for VMware EUC, joining a fabulous team with Sean and obviously a good friend of ours, Andrew Morgan. I'm sure you have a vision in your head around 60, 90, 120 days of what you want to accomplish. Could you kind of shed a light on what you think you can accomplish in the next like two or three quarters from now?
Ooh, 2 or 3 quarters might be more realistic. That the 60-day thing, I subscribe to this concept that I do not want to go in and say, hey, you're doing something wrong, before I actually understand what they're doing, how they're doing it. You know, it's kind of a throwback where people in the military, people going from one business to another, especially young people, if they did a certain task a certain way where they've been for several years and they go to this new location or new unit or new group and say, oh, you're setting that up all wrong. We used to do it this way. Well, just because they're doing it differently doesn't mean it's wrong. You have to understand, what are they doing? Why are they doing it that way? And then you might actually have a little epiphany and go, oh, well, that makes a lot more sense. But the only way you can do that is you can either criticize right off the bat, or you can understand it and then criticize and go, oh, you guys are so inefficient. Or you might have the epiphany of, oh, I totally get why you do it that way. That makes good sense. So I've actually told myself that I'm going to spend like that first 60 days learning the technologies that I don't know as well as I need to at VMware, learning the groups and the people and the nomenclature. And then once I understand something and I have an opinion, then I'll bring it up. But I don't want to bring up any opinions or try to make any changes until I actually have a really good understanding of what I'm about to criticize. As far as a couple of quarters, you know, I'm hoping to be more involved with the communities at VMware. I'm hoping the travel restrictions start to lift. I'd like to go out and start visiting user groups and visiting customers and hearing direct from customers what their challenges are. And, you know, I've already talked to several of the PMM folks within EUC. I want to talk to them about how they're getting feedback, let's say, from the communities or from customers, and how those are incorporated into prioritization. But beyond that, what I've told Sean is, you know, let's pick a spot that we think is underserved, a technology that's underserved from the CTO's office, and I'll go chase it. You know, if no one's focusing on it and it's not getting enough leverage out in the world with customers and we think it's awesome, well, let me focus on it and maybe I can take that word out to people, do some evangelism, do some training, stuff like that.
Yeah, that sounds good to me. But so short term, it's probably only the online harassment course that you have to follow and all the other mandatory trainings.
Yeah, mandatory training. And I get to go to EUC boot camp next week and stuff like that. Yeah. And I talked myself into that. I actually reached out to, you know, the head of sales and the head of the SEs. And I told them I wanted to learn how their SEs learned. You know, show me what you're teaching your field SEs. Show me how they pitch the product. Show me how your sales folks learn about the product and how they pitch it. Because again, it goes back to that first principle. I want to understand it, and I want to understand what they know before I even suggest anything, but really also so I can understand it, and maybe they're doing it right and I should pitch it the same way.
Yeah. So before we wrap this podcast up, right, I had one final question, or maybe, let me just ask it. During the introductions, we mentioned this pimped up and tuned golf carts. And I remember, I think somewhere in 2010, 2011 in Barcelona, we recorded a interview with you, and you were talking about this pimped up golf carts. Is this still something... On your driveway or in your garage, or
I still have one. When I moved from Illinois to Texas, I sold almost everything, but I kept one golf cart. At one point, I the most I've ever had at a single time was 5. and they're not set up for golf. I'm not a big golfer. They're just set up for riding around the countryside and stuff. And I've had them all. I've had them that they're jacked up and lifted like a truck. I've had them slammed to the ground where they were only an inch off the ground. And the one cart that I kept that I still have out back here, and I've tuned it down now, but at one point it was like a 38 mile an hour golf cart. It was just, it was dangerous. It had no seat belts. It was not a good thing to do. But yeah, I still have a golf cart now. now out here, I have so much more land now that I spend a lot more time, you know, checking the fences, making sure trees haven't fallen down and doing stuff on the land that I really don't. And no one around here really has golf cart but me. So it doesn't seem as important anymore, but I still like messing with it.
Yeah, so now a quarter of a mile drag race trip in the front yard.
There's no quarter mile. That would have been interesting, right? An eighth mile golf cart drag strip. That would have been cool.
Awesome. So Ron, is there anything that you want to emphasize or you want to come back to another topic that is not being covered and you desperately want to make sure that our listeners can hear this? So as a final question.
Yeah, not really. I think that, I'm still getting my feet on the ground here at VMware and still kind of learning all the people that I'll be working with and whatnot. And I don't mean directly on Sean's team, with Sean, like you said, there's Andrew who everybody, by the way, that anytime I bring up Andrew's name at VMware, they just rave about Andrew. He's a genius, basically, from what everyone tells me. There's Andrew and Brian, who I've known for a long time. And of course, there's some of the other crew that's now PMMs over there, like Gabe Knuth and Brian, his little brother, Jack. So I'm just kind of getting my feet under the ground, on the ground and underneath me. And I'm hoping to have some fun. I'm hoping to, write some articles, write some papers, maybe find some tech that I can dig into and geek out a little bit with folks and get back to the community side too.
Find some technology to geek out. That sounds awesome. So, and hopefully, as you said, the travel restrictions will get lifted anytime soon when it's safe again and people have the chance to meet you face to face, of course.
Yeah, and gotta come out your way.
Yeah, you're always welcome. Always welcome. So, yeah, we all drive golf carts here, but that's due to the size of the Netherlands, right? So, Ron, thank you very much for being our guest, and thank you all for listening. We hope you enjoyed this snack as we try to serve you the right amount of EUC for your appetite. And if you have anything you want to add here or just want to stay in touch with us, please reach out on social channels or by email, podcast@eucdigest.com. Thank you for listening again. Thank you, Ron. Thank you, Case, of course. And cheers, love, and course.
This podcast is brought to you by iGel. iGel offers the next generation edge operating system designed for simple, secure, and high-performance access to virtual desktops and cloud workspaces. Easy to implement and straightforward to operate.